welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. This is Wade here in my office, our studio, together with our returning guest, Pastor John Borderland from St. John Lutheran in Muguanago, Wisconsin, our long-absent computer janitor back from important recruitment tours to Michigan and Iowa and Nebraska and various demographics we're hoping to get some bumps in, and then also our 20-minute late co-host Peter Hermanson. Peter, I'm assuming it's the feast day of some Maximus or Pacomius or something, and the candles just weren't lighting quick enough. Would that be correct?
The feast day of backyard paver patio lane. So
the feast day of backyard paver patio. Leva already complained about your little postage stamp of a backyard. I assume you're taking even more grass away from her.
Yeah, she hasn't. She's not happy about this, but it'll give me more room to sit there and watch her and listen to her complain about how small it is. So
she'll just pine for that country living even more. We're happy to have you here with us today, as we will be discussing an exciting theme, a nice pick-me-up, death and dying. We're working on a title for the episode. You'll see when it comes out what we decide on that. But we have Pastor Borderland with us here today to talk about that, and so we'll be getting into that later, how the Christian as an individual, and then Christians as families, and then also Christians as pastors will deal with death. Here in Wisconsin, it's 90 degrees today, so we are up in the office. I will not say how many fat men there are in this office, but I will count myself as one. And so we do have the air conditioning going. It doesn't appear that the sound is picking it up, but if there is a slight buzzing, you will have to forgive us. You'll be better off for not dealing with sweaty fat us and having somewhat comfortable air-conditioned us. And so with that in mind, we will make our way into the disclaimer. Peter, would you mind? Peter, by the way, fancy new haircut, and I'm even picking up on either sweater, hair gel, or a combination of both. The hair gel for the podcast today, going above and beyond. The hair-gelled Peter Hermanson will be giving us our disclaimer.
This show does not speak for our churches, our church bodies, or our employers. To be honest, much of the time, it probably doesn't speak for us. We will be thinking out loud a lot, so approach what you hear with a healthy bit of skepticism. Because, well, as responsible residents of planet Earth, that's probably what you should generally do with almost everything. If you find yourself getting too worked up, tune out, look around, and realize you were just listening to a podcast. That's right, a podcast. So go live free, friends, and don't let us get in the way.
Which actually isn't from Scripture, so I'm going to have to beg a little bit of forgiveness. But as we talked about death and dying, the topic took me back to my parish days and got me thinking about the funerals that I have been privileged to celebrate in the parish. And I think there were two hymns that usually stood out to me. There were a number of hymns that stood out to me because they're not my favorite hymns, and they kept coming up. I got a little bit of trouble and a little bit of trouble one time for making fun of How Great Thou Art in chapel. And that's one that would oftentimes come up. And it does have one verse that talks about the Christian faith, which is nice. But I joked that I was leery of hymns that make me want to sway. But two of the hymns that oftentimes came up in the parish.
Is it a balance problem primarily for you?
it could be that too. Yeah. How Great Thou Art, that's a 3/4 meter or whatever you call it. Professor Deutschlander always told us to be very nervous of a 3/4 meter.
3/4 time.
3/4 time, whatever you call it. Yeah, whatever music people would say. And the first hymn, and I'm not going to reference from that, I'm going to talk about a verse from the second. But when I got to the parish with funerals, we started to wrestle with, well, what are we going to do when people are walking in and out? And I don't know what had been done before I got there. But at first, it was just the ringing of the bells, and some members had suggested that perhaps we could sing something in that time. And so we had a family for a funeral that picked For All the Saints as a hymn, and we would sing the first half of For All the Saints as we processed in, and the second half of For All the Saints as we processed out. And I think maybe with the exception of two or three funerals, that just took. And it was just a given that that's what families wanted for the funerals of their loved ones. And it really turned out to be a blessing for me in the sense that the gospel was preached and proclaimed before I even had to say anything as we walked in and walked out. And I think it set the tone for what had taken place, what Christ had done for this person. And so we would sing of this person's new life, continued life in Christ. The second hymn that became very popular, and I think for me, one of my favorite hymns, was hymn 588 in Christian Worship. This is the Red Wisconsin Synod hymnal, and that's Abide With Me. And I think the final verse of that hymn, at least as it appears in Christian Worship, is one of my favorite verses in the hymnal. These are both hymns now. I don't want to say the parish ruined them for me because they haven't, but they're hymns. If they come up in church now, I kind of just listen. I have a hard time singing through without not tearing up thinking of all the saints that have fallen to rest in Christ that I've had the privilege to minister to. But Abide With Me closes with these words. It says, "Hold thou thy cross before my closing eyes, shine through the gloom and point me to the skies. Heaven's morning breaks and earth's vain shadows flee. In life and death, O Lord, abide with me." And I think what a wonderful reminder there. Many times people will ask, well, what is the Christian faith about? Dr. Brown, who we had on last time, likes to talk about, well, what's the big problem or the biggest problems each religion likes to address? And I think if we take Christianity seriously, we would have to say that sin, death, and hell are the big problems, the things that Christ has come to conquer or deal with. And so it's interesting that in our day, it seems like perhaps less than ever before, we actually hear about death and dying and preparation for death. Previously in the church, you had the Ars Moriendi, or the art of dying, as you prepared, you considered how to be ready for death. It was just part of pastoral care, as death was oftentimes before the congregation to be regularly addressing it. You know, many houses, you would have the body would be set out in the house after death. Many older Milwaukee houses even still have a parlor in the front where the body could be laid out. And if everybody couldn't fit in the house, Bob could be, you know, drinking his PBR and walk by and give his, you know, final blessings to Bob or whoever had died. But death was something that was present, and now it's oftentimes been removed and it's painted up, obviously. I remember my grandmother talking about her mother dying and the whole neighborhood turning out for that. But this body being in the house for a couple of days, it's just a presence there. And so I think it's helpful as we sing a hymn like this and as we have the discussion we're having today to remember that the thing that we perhaps try most not to think about or talk about because it's most uncomfortable is the very thing that Christ has come to turn even that to our blessing, so that death becomes but the portal to life eternal. And death has lost its sting as Christ has gone before us into it. And so hopefully our prayer throughout life, those of you listening who are Christians, can be that. Hold thou thy cross before my closing eyes, shine through the gloom, and point me to the skies, a reference there to Christ will return as he ascended. Heaven's morning breaks, and earth's vain shadows flee. In life, now our daily Christian life, and death, O Lord, abide with me. And we know he does through word and sacrament. I don't want to possibly steal too much of Pastor Bordelon's thunder, but hopefully just setting the stage a little bit as we talk about something I don't know that people talk about a whole lot anymore. The reality of, at least I didn't watch the news today, but I don't think they cured death yet that I know of. The reality of death as a prospect we all, at least at the moment, will be facing. And with that, we will make our way into the free-for-all.
And we're back with the free-for-all, where we wrestle with the pressing questions of life and try to answer them once and for all. Since we have a returning guest, and since we discussed at the beginning of the baseball season, I think has the season just started, or was it just about to start when you were here?
Just about to start.
Okay.
I think Pastor Borland actually announced the Yankees were losing their first game.
That's right.
Spoiler alert,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, and I think that was the opening game.
Yeah, so we recorded during the opening day. Yeah, so we're almost to the All-Star break here, so we're about halfway through, and so we thought it would be prudent to go back and review how we think the season's going for our favorite teams and perhaps even our least favorite teams. So why don't we let our guest lead us off here? And I believe, if I remember correctly, you're a Yankees fan, correct?
Nice hair gel, Peter. Nice hair gel. You know, I started out a few months ago and said the Tigers were going to be about 500, and well, maybe a few games shy of that, but nothing that a hot September can't take care of. Get us right back up to 500. So.
Eight games. Shy
eight
of
games.
It.
Eight games out games right a few, now. Yep. You know.
I will say my prediction, I think, is looking somewhat accurate, which was, I believe, about 5 or 10 games under 500. What's most concerning for me is that they are trailing the Twins. and we're looking at possibly a fire sale and basically becoming a minor league team. And so it's disconcerting to me that before the fire sale, we still are trailing behind a minor league team.
I have to say that the Twins are, you know, they're sitting in the middle of their division right now, but they're above 500, and one of the biggest surprises to me this season, they're holding their own. And yeah, I think they are kind of a minor league team. That's occasionally the minor league team, you know, gets lucky.
The amazing thing about the Twins right now is their run differential. Runs for is 382. Runs against is 437, and they're two games above 500. I think that just says something. They're either winning close ones or getting just completely demolished. The Tigers right now runs for 402, runs against 422. But I will say that the Twins, just in spite of not really having much pitching, like my Tigers, are just finding ways to scrape by and get things done. I think the big surprise in the room might be, now that this is my second team since I married a wife who is from Wisconsin, and I've adopted the Wisconsin teams with the exception of the Packers as teams that I'll at least pull for to make her happy and do enjoy getting to go to Brewer games. I think the surprise has been Peter and Ben's Milwaukee Brewers, and so I'm curious your guys' thoughts on that, and if you think this will hold up. Today was a wonderful day after the rain delay. They thumped the Cubs, which I think everybody in America besides Cubs fans enjoys. But just general thoughts, is there an optimism here?
Well, first of all, I don't want to rub any salt in the wounds for our Tigers fans, but somebody had asked me the other day about the Brewers' young team and kind of being surprise contenders, at least at this point in the season. And I decided to look up the payroll for each MLB team for the season on opening day, and the Tigers have the fourth highest payroll in baseball.
You say you don't want to rub salt in the wound, but you are. I mean, I don't know if that's. I can see
to,
it.
To be fair, the Tigers may well purchase the Brewers lineup next year.
$199 million, $750,000 for the Tigers, and the Brewers' payroll is $63 million. So about
and seven
less than
ham
a,
sandwiches.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit than less than a third.
And three Miller Lights.
Yeah, I would say that. I mean, the Brewers have been, you know, I think Ben and I both kind of said we were hoping they'd be around 500. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, they were supposed to have the good prospects, but it was supposed to be way too early.
Yeah, no, and I think I said they're a year, maybe 2 years away, and they've come out and surprised now. The difficulty is you have all these young players that are playing well, and you don't know if that's going to last. Sometimes they get hot and then they disappear. So, you know, they seem like they're having fun. It's a young team that really just loves playing the game. And I don't get to watch many games because cable, expensive. But my dad does. He gets home and watches just about every game. And he always says this is the most fun he's had watching Brewers ball in a long time. Sounds a lot like, I think it was 2008 when they had Fielder and Braun were young, and... you know, Lou Croy, I think, was there already, and Ricky Weeks, and they were a fun team to watch that year too.
And it was it 2 years ago or 3 years ago they had a real surprise hot first part of the season and just were making music videos, whatever else, having a ball.
Yeah, I think it was 2 years ago.
That was not last year.
Not last year, no.
No, I would like to see them make a nice little playoff run. I think they're positioned to at least get a wild card. I think if the Cubs were going to get hot, it needs to happen soon because they seem to be getting a little bit down on themselves and turning on each other. It's nice to see that for me, so that's the satisfaction I can take. And if any team besides the, except for the Tigers, is going to make a run, it'd be good to see the Brewers do it. I do think that part of the problem is that if the Tigers' pitchers were hitting, maybe they would be winning some of these games. So I'm just joking. I still think we should have the DH.
Pastor, let me ask you this. Now that you've been in Wisconsin for a couple years, is there any expectation from any of your members that you kind of have to, you know, have to root for the home teams, or are they pretty much let you keep your allegiances and talk about that?
There's some expectation, and yes, we keep our allegiance. But, yeah, I mean, when you first break it to the child in Sunday school that you're not a Packer fan, you know, and you see them crushed. But, you know, they get over it. You know, it's good.
You don't have any animosity against the Brewers, though, necessarily, do you?
No, no. In fact, it is kind of fun to follow them. I enjoy going to a game, taking the kids to the stadium. So I would say my favorite National League team, if I can say that.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. There seem to be so many people from, you know, transplants from outside of the state who, you know, warm up to the Brewers pretty quickly, but the Packers just...
I wonder why that is.
I don't know.
Can't quite put my thumb on it. If it's, you know, maybe I'll just stop there.
Well, it is interesting. You can talk to the same people from Wisconsin, when they're talking about the Brewers, there's just not the hostility. And part of it, I think, is they're not the same division as the Tigers or something else. I don't even think you have that necessarily with Brewers fans as much with Cubs fans or Cardinal fans as you do once it gets to Packers. And maybe that's just the nature of the NFL or whatever the case may be. But I do find most of the Brewer fans I know just pretty good-natured about it. They're kind of excited to see their team doing well, better than expected. And, you know, you can go and you're not gonna get too much grief. I can't say what it's like to be a Cardinal fan or a Cub fan at Miller Park, but I can say I've never seen someone get a hard time from anyone.
Well, usually when the Cubs are there, they draw more of their own fans than Milwaukee.
Yeah, they used to call it Wrigley North, I know, so...
Although the satisfying thing is, like when they come up, this season basically the Brewers have been kind of putting the hurt on them. Sometimes it's nice to just think about that drive back to Chicago, their bankrupt state, and as they have to dwell on what happened.
Wait, Illinois is bankrupt. When did this happen?
I don't know if they're officially bankrupt. I think they're just trying to finalize it at this point.
They have junk bond status, and they just they're voting now for like a 30%. Income tax increase on all their residents, so they'll have a nice new tax to pay coming soon.
I also think if you're walking down the street, politicians are legally allowed to pick one pocket and stick their hand in and take whatever they find in it. I was concerned. I think it was the Chicago Tribune. Is that the main paper there? Had an article suggesting that Indiana and was it Iowa and Wisconsin absorb parts of Illinois, and it was suggesting that we would get the Chicago part, which seems to be probably the most problematic part for bankruptcy. And so I just want to come out as being very against that. I would like maybe us to look at some sort of border wall or fence should the bankruptcy try to begin to take effect. I think that they look at these free roads we have up here, even if they're in rough condition, and not the lowest taxation, but reasonable, and just it's not full of, is it Illinoisans? I don't know. A good term
for
Illinoisians. I don't think I want any of Illinois. I mean, the downtown Chicago would be nice. You could do some stuff with it, but I think you'd have to almost say this is for Wisconsin people now. We're going to keep it real nice.
Yeah, when I saw that article, Wade, I thought, he's going to start an argument between Indiana and Wisconsin, who has to take Chicago, right?
It's, yeah, what I think should happen is just Ohio has to take it as like a floating, you know, it's just...
And Gary, too, right?
Yeah, right, and Gary, Indiana, yeah. I think if all that could just together go to Ohio, you could combine my two least favorite states.
We could gerrymander this, put it like down the interstate, like Ohio just has an interstate that connects to Gary and then to Chicago.
A skyway, maybe, so it doesn't actually have to touch and pollute the rest of Indiana.
This is interesting that this has kind of gone... off the subject in this direction, because I was having a debate with all my siblings today. We were chatting online, and we were trying to rank the Midwestern states from best to worst. And I don't want to upset anybody, so I won't come out with the results. But, yeah, it's just interesting hearing other people talk. I will say that we all agreed that, I'm not going to say anything.
I will point out that we do love our listeners in Illinois or Ohio, and generally Illinois and Ohio Lutherans. So it's more the state, I think, than the inhabitants of it. I was just on vacation at my brother's place in Ohio. They were very hospitable. It was lovely. It was nice. But it just being from Michigan, you know, especially with Ohio, we went to war with Ohio over Toledo. We won. Ohio had to keep it. You know, there's just some bad blood there. And I think most people, natives from Wisconsin, you know, you're driving in the expressway, someone does something crazy, and you almost know what plate to expect to see on the car. But, I don't know. John, any thoughts on that? Or
no, I was just
John, now, you have Chicago connections.
Yeah, I was just wondering if Sarah should share this. My wife, Sarah, she should share this on her Facebook account for all my family that lives in Illinois. And I'm glad that Ben pulled back the reins, didn't want to offend anyone after those 5 minutes.
It wasn't actually, spoiler alert, it wasn't Illinois that was in last place. So I'll let you guess, but...
It better not have been Michigan. Iowa? I don't want to hurt our Iowa...
Well, we should get back to baseball so that we don't get the internet shut off in these states. For
so I
for
am just
website.
Curious though, since you have family there, would you like to see Wisconsin adopt that part of Illinois?
No, you know, unless I was going to leave Wisconsin.
I know you like going down there. You get the Coney dogs, whatever else. Maybe those will go half price now.
Yeah. No, let's not do that.
All right, I can tell John is trying not to offend his family in Illinois. If you could put in the show notes, just tag family members, if you can maybe go on their Facebook account and find people.
Yep, we'll get that done.
That might be helpful. Otherwise, Brewers are doing great. Tigers, fire sale. Cubs are struggling.
So what's your prediction for the second half of the season for the Tigers? What do you think is going to happen? Are they going to – you're saying fire sale. Do you think they will? Do you think they'll just try to – you know, unload and then reload? Or
is Kevorkian still alive? if he is, I think maybe they can just go for a ride in his van. And that might be the best solution at this point. But I think at some point they have to get what they can get and restock. The farm system just doesn't have much otherwise.
They're going to wind up 4 games under 500. I will, you know, I'll scale it back a few games from them. But they're going to do all right.
Did you want to add to that any hostility towards Chicago?
No, we'll leave. You know, the White Sox. We didn't talk about the White Sox, huh?
No.
Speaking of minor league programs.
Huh. I'm trying to look now. Are they ahead of our Tigers?
Oh, they're 10 back, so they're okay. You know, you got 2 games on them. Or
yeah, they're
a game.
They're in dead last in the division.
I usually don't hear much about them unless, like, some of their fans beat up an ump or something at a game.
Or if they start 2-1 and are in first place.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Usually the first week of the season we hear from White Sox fans.
I feel like we did some damage to our listenership. I'm going to have to look at our Illinois and Ohio numbers. We may want to edit this out later. that escalated quickly.
Got a little out of hand. I'll say with the Brewers, I think the big question I've been having with the debate I've been having with my friends and family has been, so what do they, the plan was that they would unload to pick up some more talent, you know, about halfway through the season, expecting that they'd be slightly under 500, and now they're first in the division. The division's a lot weaker than they expected. So now what do? Do they make a run for it? And as I've been looking at it more, and I don't keep my finger on the pulse completely here, but as I look at it, I think they've got so much young talent coming up, even if they don't, you know, try to stock up even more. I think that they're still in good shape, so I think they'll probably kind of ride this out. They maybe even will pick up a someone for the bullpen, and they've got starting pitching that's you know, if it can stay decent, I think they can hold on to the division or at least sneak in a wild card. So that's my prediction. I think they stay over 500 now. I'm more optimistic. Ben, do you agree or disagree?
I they might stay over 500. I don't know. I just think there's too much season left.
I will just close by noting that looking at our listenership statistics, I've just observed that Illinois is our fourth leading state for downloads. And so I, on Pastor Borland's behalf, would like to issue a formal apology for him turning this so hostile against the wonderful state of Illinois.
I don't know that we need to apologize. It's not the state itself or the people that live there. It's the politicians, right?
I'm going to go with that. Yeah, let's just, we can all...
We have nothing against Illinois.
Ben lived in Illinois.
Yeah.
He turned out
If any of our listeners, you know, are still upset, we apologize for having Pastor Bortland on. We will try to prevent that in the future.
It is a podcast.
I will note Ohio, though, is probably about 14th or 15th for states now. And my encouragement is I will, on an upcoming episode, give Ohio props. I will sing some praises of Ohio. If it can surpass, it's right now just above Utah and trailing Georgia. It's actually behind Alaska. If it can surpass Alaska, if they can make a big push, share it, our friends in Ohio, I will sing some praises of Ohio. And not even sarcastic praises, because I think I could do that fantastically. But I will say some sincerely nice things about the Buckeye State. All right, I think our free-for-all is running long again, just like last time we had John in the studio with us. He just gets so talkative. And so we will make our way now here to the main topic. Episode titles, maybe it might be something like Ars Moriendi or The Art of Dying, but kind of hitting upon how the Christian church or individual Christians or people, last time we talked about from the pulpit and from the pew with Pastor Bortland, how different Christians and their different vocations might deal with this, with death itself, the thing that happens. And dying, the process that some may go through, others may be spared that. But I think we may even have thoughts on, are we really being spared if we don't have the process? Sometimes I think the process of dying can actually be very salutary and beneficial for some people as well. I know, John, we've talked about this a number of times personally as people whose vocations touch upon it. Mine for 10 years in the parish, but now still teaching today, especially teaching ethics, dealing with end-of-life issues a lot. And yours as a parish pastor, if I might just briefly, I won't give too many details of the story, but maybe a month or two ago, we were heading out, and John had picked Ben and I up, and we were going to go to a local establishment to enjoy some conversation. And as he was driving us there, he got a phone call that a member, I believe it was a member, had died, and I almost just said passed there, but maybe we can talk about the euphemisms we use later. But he had died, and so we got dropped off and got a ride home from someone else, and John was off to be a pastor to a family grieving with an unexpected death, not to go into too many details. And so maybe you can just hit upon for us, John, some initial thoughts that come to mind or things that you've been thinking about as you've gotten ready for this, of death and dying and the different perspectives there might be on that.
Yeah, and thanks, Wade, for starting on the pastoral perspective. I'd say probably the first thing, you know, coming face-to-face with death, you know, and I think anyone can remember that, the first funeral you had to go to, you know, and whether that, probably in a lot of instances, a grandparent, you'd think, maybe, and you're at that age and you're holding on to mom and dad's hand when you go up to view one who has passed on or went to a better place. Let's just say it. I can still remember my uncle. My grandma died in fifth grade. Let's just cut it out. She died, huh? Let's talk about it how it is. So one of the most vivid memories I have would have been when I was in college. My grandpa was, you know, a Detroit policeman, you know, Detroit cop, tough. And cancer did what cancer does to a person. And that last year was tough. The night before he died, his pastor drove by one evening. I think it was after 9 o'clock, if I'm remembering the story right. And said, you know, I haven't seen Al for a couple of weeks. And drove by his house, and the light was on, and he turned around, and he went back. And he visited with my grandpa. I'm sure they talked about the tires. They probably were about 500 at that time. but, of course, they talked about what really mattered. And he gave my grandfather his Lord's body and blood and sang the Nunc Dimittis. And I'd like to say my grandpa woke up singing with saints and angels in heaven. And so I would like to say that's had a positive influence on me as I consider my work as pastor with the dying, kind of the singing their way into heaven. And you referenced that evening a month ago, and it's one of those things you can't prepare for that in a classroom. I can't say I was even prepared for it that evening, but there's no place you'd rather be, right? With one who is dying, or with the family of one who has died in the Lord. As we sing in the Lenten hymn, the one who dies in faith dies well. And so what's the role of the pastoral ministry? To continue to proclaim the Christ to ones in need, because they're going to face this thing called death.
And I think it maybe is helpful just to even briefly consider the place of death in Christian theology, and that's namely that human beings weren't created to die, right? This wasn't part of our original DNA, something that was supposed to take place, that mankind was created good, very good. And death is something that has come into the world through sin. And that can be through my own personal sin. For instance, I could die in some sin I'm committing. But more broadly, through sin itself, just that we are inherently sinful. We have what is called original sin. And so as we talk about death and that prospect, as John is mentioning, the fact that this is something that even Christians will struggle with, that even Christ himself in Gethsemane in near torment could say, Father, if it's possible that this cup passes from me, that he can cry out as the sinner in our place, having become sin so that we might become the righteousness of God. My God, why have you forsaken me? That the shortest verse in the Bible is shrouded in death. Jesus sees what death has done to the people mourning Lazarus, his friend, and he weeps. And so if you're listening to this, and at any point we're getting a little bit too woozy about death, I don't think we are at all. I think especially those of us who have been on the pastoral side of it can speak of it in a way that maybe seems rosy sometimes, because we know what's happening there and we've seen Christ at work. But understanding if listening about death or thinking about death causes some discomfort in you, that's perfectly natural, and it isn't even really in any way a commentary on your faith. This is something that we will struggle with as sinner saints with throughout life.
Yeah, I think, you know, very well intentioned, but one of the least helpful things you can say to somebody is, well, a Christian's never afraid of dying, or its cousin at a funeral, you know, well, you shouldn't be sad today. You know, you can take both of those topics up with Jesus, huh? Jesus faced with the prospect of death, as you referenced in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus wept at the grave of his friend Lazarus, and he knew what he was going to do, right? Yeah. So, this unnatural thing. We were not created to die. And how important the Christian faith, right? This is about a resurrection, not about a happy place, not about going to a better place. This is about a resurrection.
We've talked about this a couple times, but in an earlier episode.
You're not going to take this to purgatory now, are you, Peter?
No.
Okay.
I think it was episode 2, actually. We talked about the human condition. We talked about the problem of pain or the problem of evil, but all of that really points ultimately to death, right? And the problem, the final problem here is that pain, evil, all of this, it ends it terminally, right? And that's I've said a couple of times, I know, that this is quintessentially human. Right. I mean, this is how we experience humanity. And, you know, you've said, both of you have said now, you know, we weren't made to die. And yet this is, you know, kind of in a way more human than anything else. This is what we deal with. So when we have these, you know, this angst as we think about death, especially I think as we get closer to it, it's very natural because it's going to happen. Right. The old saying, the only two things you can be sure of are death and taxes. And really, the only thing you can be sure of is death. And
if you live in Illinois, death and new income tax.
Peter, you mentioned that, and I'll admit, in my trip to Ohio, I listened to and then read a lot of Kierkegaard. And so you mentioned the angst, and that gets me thinking of that.
How many people you think driving through Indiana were listening to Kierkegaard last week for the 4th of July week? I mean, just round estimates.
20% maybe?
Yeah. 20%. Yeah. Okay, good.
There's not much to do listen to in Indiana. There's Christian stations, country stations, and I think maybe
God
NPR.
Bless the USA or anything
like
that.
Yeah, that was on a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is one of the things that I appreciate about Kierkegaard is he hates, you know, superficialities. And, you know, his recognition of there is this anxiety or this angst that is part of the Christian life. And it's not even just for the Christian. It's part of life. People just don't want to admit it in general. That when we kind of bear back from things that, as you said, part and parcel of life in a fallen world, and that's the only world we know, right? In a fallen world is this... We see cycles of death and dying all the time. You know, spring turns to winter. Winter, hopefully, prayerfully, in Wisconsin, turns to spring and summer.
Yeah, that was a good week, that spring.
Yeah, it was. I enjoyed it. But
wait, if I might, I don't want to interrupt, but you mentioned before something almost like you're almost cheated if you don't go through this process. And it's just a real helpful thing to think about because, again, to avoid it at all costs, right? Just like the life, avoid any pain or suffering. Or no, maybe the Lord does have something good. He's going to work through this. And I mean, you talk about the superficialities, you know, and think about things that are set at a casket, you know, and doesn't he look nice? Well, actually, he looks dead. He looks dead with a bunch of cheap. I did say it once. Maybe that was one of those things where Sarah looked at me, you know, after the funeral, like, nah, you shouldn't have said, he looks dead up there.
But I think, you know, as you hit on that too, pain, even itself, it's this thing we recoil from. And I think I think the episode that probably has performed least well was maybe the one Peter and I maybe enjoyed the most because we just got to talk a bunch of philosophy. But, you know, pain and suffering is something I think today more than ever we recoil from and we try to keep at arm's length. And almost any argument that comes down to that borders on pain and suffering, our default as a culture is to err on the side that minimizes pain or suffering. And so we take this as though pain and suffering are always bad things. And I think this becomes dangerous in the Christian faith too, because how many Christians don't want a God who takes away suffering? And this is, I think, where Christian faith really comes to maturity is when it realizes that actually the opposite might take place. You have a Christ who has suffered for you, who takes your hand and leads you through suffering as we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And you grow out of that discontent with a God who doesn't give you everything, this pain-free, suffering-free life. When I burn my hand touching the stove, that can be a wonderful blessing. It keeps me from further injury. You know, a pain-free life could be an exceptionally dangerous life if you're missing out on important reminders or cues to further danger. And what could be more dangerous than to be denied any cue of your living in a fallen world, that death is there, death is coming, and you're approached at the last minute and ill-equipped to take it in. It's just not part of your worldview or on your horizon at all. And so that sometimes in ministry we can even see someone goes through this time of pain and suffering. And I'll admit, I'm not a crier, but there were plenty of times I ended up just crying with people because there was nothing I could say that was going to make the pain or suffering better or take it away. And I thought, this is terrible what they're going through. I would not want to go through it. But at the same time, people that I'm in contact with or I remain in contact with, and I know now they wouldn't trade that for anything. Their marriage became stronger or their faith became stronger or they were pushed to make changes in their life that ended up to be for their long-term benefit or... horror of all horrors, they went to be with Jesus, right? This can be something I think that is a message that the Christian church has for the world that's exceptionally important today, is that, you know, try as you might, you're not going to... Pain and suffering are just here. You might as well at least have a way to process them. And that's what the cross is able to do. One thing I'm curious about, John, and I know we don't want to give too many specifics. My first deathbed experience where I thought I was getting ready to be at a deathbed as one of my saints was going home to heaven, just refused to die. And I was there, and I stayed overnight in the hospital. You know, 3 days we thought he was dying. And it actually ended up being the last funeral I did before I left to come out here 10 years. I joked with him. He was running on all fake parts. It was just such an interesting experience for me. That's something in my vicar year I had not done a lot of. And people will ask me now, what's one of some of the things you miss from the ministry? And almost always one of the top things is being at deathbeds. And I remember going into that situation thinking, well, what am I going to do? I really had no clue. But then getting to where it became comforting to me to watch the comfort take hold in people that the Lord was calling home. I'll admit sometimes I thought this person's not going to die well. And by that, I didn't mean, you know, they're going to be eaten by rats or something, which is one of the ways I would prefer not to die. But, you know, maybe they were ones that didn't struggle, they didn't handle adversity well throughout much of their life. And sometimes those would be the ones who would find the most peace in Christ. And that always comforted me because I think if I were going to put someone on the top of the list for won't die well, it would probably be me, because I can complain exceptionally about things that most other people would just think that's part and parcel of being an adult. Anything that, as you entered into the ministry and then now as you've progressed in it, that you've learned from deathbeds or been taught by it, or just where does that rank in the things you do as a pastor?
Yeah, no, and a lot of thoughts there. It is a joy, a pure joy and a privilege, an undeserved privilege to be able to be at those deathbeds. I mean, first, on the lighter side, you talk about the guy who wouldn't die. Remember the one guy where in the pastor's companion, you know, the commendation of the dying,
yep.
You know, Lutheran's last rites, you know. I mean, I used that one three times on the guy, and, you know, finally, you know, and then I helped him load up his suitcase to take him home. You know, we thought, you know, that was, you know, one of the things, you talk about going to those visits and you often receive more than you give. I think about watching people die in faith, and what a blessing they never would have thought about in these terms. What a blessing they were to their family who was there, but also, I guess, to the congregation, as I took those experiences and were able to serve people down the road, whether that was in preaching or pastoral care, singing at deathbeds, I've literally lost count how many people have gone to heaven listening to my bad singing. And then somewhere,
which
by
made
the,
it probably feel all the sweeter.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that's what Isaiah Mighty Seer is supposed to sound like, you know. But then somewhere, where did that click along the line? Well, if you're going to be singing to them when they're dying, that became a regular part, is still a regular part of my pastoral care, and not just with the older ones, but with the youth. Sarah, my wife, right now is choosing the music for our vacation Bible school coming up, and I'll remind her. Remember to teach the kids to sing what I want them to sing to me when I'm dying. You know, I don't want to hear about the happy train to heaven when I'm dying. There's better stuff out there.
Not what she'll be singing, right? Because then I would go,
yeah,
that joy.
I don't know what she'll be singing, you know, with the pillow over my, you know. Let me out. Sorry, dear.
You mentioned that, the singing, and I'll admit that something... I know the companion had that in there, and if I could get the family to sing with me, I would do that, but I'm not a confident singer by myself. But one of the things I found with the devotions was you could just cut to the chase. You didn't have to sell anything. It was, you're there, they know what's happening, you know what's happening. And probably, I would say, my best sermons on Sundays, from the perspective of people actually responding to them and saying that, not that I thought they were the best, were ones that were crafted in the midst of deathbed ministry, and extremely helpful for remembering what I'm bringing to this person, right? The gospel should be definitive of everything I'm doing. This is not just something that now they're ready for because they're dying. And it shaped my Sundays to where I thought each of my sermons should be a funeral sermon. And from the perspective of, if that person leaves church and drives home and dies, what was the last thing they heard about Christ? And I think that opened my eyes a lot to that.
I think that's where the nature of preaching, the for you declaration of preaching, the dear saint, how many conversations we had. But the conversation, he said, you know, Pastor, I know my next trip out of this nursing home is with Paul being the funeral director. I mean, so what you talk about at that time, right? You cut the qualifiers, you cut the strings, and there it is. This is for you, Christ for you. So,
what about the place in your ministry of the sacrament with respect to the death, to the dying?
I'm for it.
Do you find, obviously you take it to them. Do you find it provides any specific opportunities maybe our listeners might think about for preaching and for, I guess, just preparation for death? That maybe our listener, for instance, when they're going to communion next time they're in church, might bring to bear as they themselves, maybe having listened to this, think about their own death.
Yeah. We were up in Eau Claire. Was that last weekend or 2 weekends ago? Our kids playing a softball turn up there. One of my cousins was just installed in a country church about an hour north of Eau Claire and stopped.
Is this a church that country music themed church? Like
this too, yes. Okay. Yeah. We stopped to visit them, had dinner, and walked over to see the church. And it has an old communion rail in that half circle. Now, I don't know where I ever heard this from, but that it came from the Norwegians, this half circle altar rail that is a picture of every time you kneel to receive the Lord's Supper there, you're reminded of those who now rest from their labors, who feast at the eternal banquet. So for the listener, you know, every time you go to the table, union with your Lord and remembering those who are home, and then you walk away, right, in peace. Lord, you let your servant depart in peace. This is what it's about, in peace, because of Christ. I'm ready. I'm ready.
And I think if we think of the supper as foretaste, right, this is a foretaste of something. Taste and see that the Lord is good. We get a helpful reminder there too, because I think sometimes people can approach death as, well, now it's an escape from the body and from earthly things. And what does the Lord do? He says, no, take and eat, right? And we're reminded we're not escaping from the body and earthly things. Christ has come to redeem and to renew us so that we might have an eternity at the resurrection of the living and the dead, of these good gifts that God has given now, uncorrupted and without sinful taint and spoiling. And so I think, for me, even when I go to the Lord's Supper now, as you're mentioning, I can think of those who have gone before me who wait and say, how long, O Lord, for that same feast that we have been called to as well. Peter, you look like you had something you were going to say before.
Well, yeah, Pastor had mentioned the Nuc Dimittis.
Why do you have so many candles out over there? I'm sorry, just go ahead.
I didn't have a chance to talk. I just had to keep myself occupied. I always... The Nuc Dimittis is always it's one of my favorite parts of the of the service. And Wade, you had said that you're not much of a crier, and I don't proudly admit that I am. Like I start tearing up and try to choke it back pretty easily. And the Nuc Dimittis is one of those places where there are times where it just kind of hits me. Think about where it comes from with Simeon. He's prepared to die, right? And this is, he just has this one promise kind of held out there, and he's saying, I'm ready now, right? You've made me ready, and you've given me this great gift. And that's what it's just so fitting. And it is really kind of pulls you back into, I mean, pulls you into death in a very real way. Not only obviously with Jesus' body and blood, right? And we talk a lot about his life, but his death there, right? That's what we're seeing. And but then also reminding us of, where this ultimately leads, and it becomes a joy for us, even while we struggle with it as, as to our humanity, we might say. Speaking of that, I sometimes kick myself when I say, all humanity has the same problem, and that's death, and Christianity has an answer. But really, we don't have an answer for death, right? We just have a perspective. And I try to remind myself, and that is an important distinction. Because we run away otherwise with these sorts of dualisms where our answer is the spirit never dies, the soul never dies, and so the body isn't really us then in a sense. And this modern dualism that I think can be really dangerous to the church and leads, you know, theologically, it might seem benign at first, but leads down some really, you know, ugly roads. Reminding us that no, we don't have an answer for death, right? Death will come. Death came in Jesus. It's going to come for us. But that there's a perspective we have for that that now allows us with Simeon to say, you know, I'm ready. This is, you know, you've blessed me, and you know, my eyes have seen my salvation here.
And I think you mentioned, you know, kind of this dualism we can have towards it, and maybe that's just briefly a good spot for us to hit on the role that euphemisms play in talking about death so often. You know, I really try hard to not correct people, you know, every time they use a euphemism for it. And some of them can be tied back to biblical themes, some maybe not as much. But if you ever are at a funeral or even at a hospice or things of this nature, it's really interesting to listen to how many times someone actually says death or die, and how many times some other word is used. And sometimes it's almost like Star Trek words, as if they've just now faded and been transported or something. Sometimes it is words that more closely connect. You know, they fell asleep in Jesus. What a wonderful Christian phrase. But I'm thinking particularly now, and I don't know if this came up in a previous episode we have, but I grew up in the Roman Catholic Church, so I was familiar with ashes that way. I didn't do ashes at my home parish. We don't currently have them at the parish I'm at now. But I know a number of Lutheran churches have adopted this practice, and one of the things I've had several brothers comment on is how troubling it is to put ashes on their own children when they come forward on Ash Wednesday, because here comes, you know, you would gladly die 10 times before they would die once, and you say to them, dust you are, and to dust you will return, and mark their very foreheads with, upon which the waters of baptism were placed with these ashes. How do you kind of deal with presenting death as it is? It's a broad question. I don't know if there's a good way to answer it, but
presenting it to who? I mean,
just when you deal with it in the congregation, whether it be in your Sunday preaching or in Bible class or at a funeral where you have people who, like it or not, are in a room with a casket, and it's, you know, do you get down to brass tacks or do we polish it up?
Yeah, right. So pastoral care, and you think just the raw emotion with death, and maybe to differentiate between the actual time of death versus a few days to a week later when you are celebrating the Christian funeral. One of the customs in Nebraska, we had a church cemetery, so it was always the burial right after the funeral, and then after the committal, you would go and greet all the family members, you know. And what do you say to those five sitting in the chair next to the casket? And I guess something that I adopted was, you know, Jesus will give him back to you. You know, as far as so many ways you can talk about this thing called death, but this body, this one who you loved, will be raised to life again. And in faith, those who die in faith die well. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your broad topic or not. So,
well, I think that, I mean, it sounds like from what Wade was saying, you know, you can have your euphemisms that just avoid talking about the reality, and they have no basis in scripture or anything, you know, talking about the person, you know, transcending on, you know, whatever, you know, to a new...
Holes in the floor of heaven, yeah, and she's new, looking right out after you, yeah. That was a request for a funeral song once. When I first funeral as a pastor, I asked, any suggestions for hymns? And I got Holes in the Floor of Heaven.
But then there are obviously very comforting ways to talk about it that are scriptural. So I, you know, differentiating between those kind of cliche, folksy euphemisms, and then, but we can say something equally comforting that has its basis in scripture, has its full comfort in the resurrection in Christ.
No, and it doesn't take away the pain, right? I mean, like, and that's what I think we oftentimes look for, is we want to end the pain. We want the morphine, right? Can't do that. And that's, I guess, what I was hinting at before when I said we don't have an answer for this, right? We just have a perspective. And that doesn't make it any easier. It doesn't, you know, it isn't a morphine shot. But it does allow us, you know, to to step back and recognize, you know, the gifts of God, even in those most painful moments. So,
a perspective and a proclamation, then, right? As you're talking about what to say to someone, a living name to proclaim.
And I think one of my stories I enjoy from the parish is, I think, illustrates a little bit the approach the Christian can have to death, but also one that can sometimes be surprising to people around them. I had, when I first got to the parish, just a wonderful saint. His name was Frank, and he had very colorful sport coats. Oftentimes they matched the liturgical color of the year. And he said, "Pastor, I want to take you out to dinner, and you always take me out for a nice German dinner, which I'm never going to say no to." And he'd say, "I probably won't be around at Thanksgiving, you know, but I just appreciate everything you're doing." And Christmas would pass, and he'd say, "Pastor, I want to take you out to dinner." And he'd say, "I probably won't be around at Easter." And this would repeat, and probably it must have repeated, I would guess, 3, 4, 5 years. And so finally, Frank, who had lived a nice long life, I think he was in his upper 90s maybe, his wife had already gone home to heaven, and he was just ready, not in a way that he despised life. He loved a great German dinner. He could socialize in the back of church forever. He loved the good gifts of this life, but he could let the bird fly, I guess. And he went into the hospital, and he said something to the nurses that really troubled them. And so I went to visit him, and they pulled me aside, and they said, "You're his pastor?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, we're worried about him." And I thought, "This is interesting. Well, why are you worried about him?" They said, "He came in and said, 'I've had my casket for 20 years, and I want to use it.'" And
that's
he had.
A great line.
He had bought the casket 20 years earlier. I don't know if he got a good deal on it or what, but it had been in storage. And I said, "There's absolutely nothing wrong with him. That's Frank, and he loves his Lord." And that time, the Lord did eventually call him home. And it was, I think, striking to me just the balance that he had for enjoying the good gifts here. "Pastor, let's go eat." But also appreciating the good gifts that awaited. And I think there's something freeing in that when the Christian can view these things for what they are. Luther says in the Heidelberg Disputation, when he talks about the theology of the cross, the theologian of the cross calls the thing what it is. That's death. That's suffering.
That's my casket.
Pain.
That's
right.
My casket. Yeah.
It sounds like
yeah.
Peter's dealing morphine over there, but even if he can't get some, you know, this is life in a fallen world, but it's still a life filled with gifts, and it's still a life that I have Jesus in. And so it's one in which I can find blessing, and one in which I can be blessing to others, and be able to pray. You and Peter have both reinforced the Nunc Dimittis, "Lord, let your servant now depart in peace according to your word." And what a wonderful blessing. There's a, I don't want to plug something I translated, but I will.
I'll link to it, Wade.
There you go. The Sacred Meditations by Johann Gerhard, or John Gerhard. He had a prolonged period of sickness and writes these meditations influenced by a number of the church fathers. And he has a couple that deal with death. And one of them is Consolation in the Death of Friends. And just a half a paragraph, he says, "Life is full of burdens. Therefore, the alleviation of them is good. The misery of the Christian, not the Christian himself, dies. The departure of the soul that we suppose to be death is not an exit, but a transition. We don't lose our loved ones. We send them on before us." And I always love that from a Christian perspective. We send them on before us. Think of Abraham traveling in the wilderness or others, and you send some on before. "They do not die, but arise. They precede us, not leave us. They depart. It is not death, but departure. The migration of the pious is to renewal. The funerals of the pious are a kind of collection of interest, cashing in this life on loan for the real benefits in eternity. Our loved ones die. See in this that they cease sinning, cease being tossed about, cease being miserable. They die in the faith. See in this that they depart from the shadow of life so that they pass through to true life, out of darkness and into light, from men to God. Life is a voyage. Death is its safest port." And I don't think Gerhard means that in some depressing, you know, my kids might say emo, you know, sort of way. And not in a way that he's despising this life either, because he has other devotions that show he's no ascetic. But recognizing that Christ in his goodness has turned even death from curse to gift, right? That he works through this now for our benefit. In fact, it's by his death we're either the most perverse people in the world or something important really happened for our benefit there. We celebrate it as Good Friday, not Terrible Friday. Good Friday. By his death, now he has worked us life. I don't know, John, if you have any more thoughts, things you've been thinking about with regard to this. I've talked too much.
No, and, you know, just kind of in way of summary, you know, when you mentioned this topic, I kind of jumped at it. Wade, I think you know, was it 3 weeks ago, you know, my stepfather was called home to his eternal rest. And just as it happened, that morning I was at a service listening to my kids sing in a choir, Isaiah Mighty Seer, and then the phone call comes. And you see it as a pastor, and then to see it from the family perspective, a man who was baptized in his late 50s and confirmed in the Lutheran faith, who says, I wish I would have known this longer so I would have known Jesus longer, but I'll know him forever. That's dying in faith. And his pastor stands up a few days later and leaves no doubt where our comfort is found. And just the joy that comes from a Lord who knocks the teeth out of death. There's a resurrection, you know, which allows us to live freely now, huh? Which allows us to after Walt's funeral dinner, ham, you know, to go back and to laugh and to sing and to laugh and to cry, of course, and to laugh and then to serve this life that's been given to us here.
And I don't know that that is an apology for the Christian faith in the sense of a defense, anything that's going to convince someone to believe. But I think there's something in your experience there that gets at what someone has to get around if they want to honestly deal with the Christian faith. And that's the fact that God has revealed himself. He has stepped into human history, and he's done so precisely at and for those moments. And if someone can find anything that can grapple with those moments in any nearly so meaningful way, graceful, gifted way, I would be happy to consider that. But I think we see the real value and purpose of Christianity in those moments when God in his word steps in and just fills your ears and your hearts with a hope that isn't, you know, I hope the Tigers end up above 500 or I hope I win the lottery, but a hope that you really got to work hard to get around. You know, this is just the case and deal with it. No wooing, it just is, it's given. And so, you know, I know that's something you guys have had going as a family, and it's always interesting to see how Christians grapple with those things. And so I'm glad God gave you a preacher for such moments and that you are a preacher for such moments as well. I said I wouldn't talk too much anymore. Ben and Peter, any thoughts on this?
Well, I just wanted to, just a quick disclaimer. Wade mentioned hope to win the lottery. You may not play the lottery in Illinois anymore. They shut that down because of their huge tax problems.
They're taking away hope.
Peter, any thoughts you have on that?
One thing that we haven't really touched on a whole lot, I think you maybe mentioned it when you were talking about the Abide With Me, the fifth verse or final verse, whatever that is. But the idea that, you know, in life and death are connected in this way, and we, you know, it's not this Buddhist understanding of, you know, the circle of life in that sense, but there is a connection. And I always remember my grandma, when my wife had our first child, I called her up from Texas and, you know, said, hey, grandma, you know, have big news, and tell her, you know, she has another great-grandchild. And her very first words are, oh, man, there are going to be so many people at my funeral. And I had my second daughter, and my wife had my second daughter. I called her up, and the exact same thing. Very first words out of her mouth. And she only lived to see those two of my children. But, you know, I made sure they were both there, and they were both pretty young. And I remember telling them, you know, hey, she was, you know, this is your great-grandma. And she was really excited to have you here. Like, you know, I mean, we were sad and we cried. And, you know, my youngest, who I think was about 4 or 5 at the time, when they closed the coffin, said, why are they closing it on Grandma Ruth? Right? What are they doing? You know, are they going to let her out? And, you know, had to go through that. But kind of, you know, with those young children, to be able to go through that process and explain why she was so happy about them being at her funeral was not because, you know, she was just a necrophilia that just couldn't wait to die and just, you know, that's all she thought about, but rather that it was, you know, she was looking at the connection here and her confidence in the death in Christ.
And I maybe just in closing, and then we'll let Pastor Borderland take it to an end. But something, as John and Peter were talking, that strikes me as well, that I think just given the focus of our podcast, it's helpful to mention. We're all about examining the baptismal life here. And I think maybe something that wasn't mentioned too much earlier but could be drawn out is that for the Christian in their baptism, they've already died the big death. You know, they have died to trespasses and sins. Their spiritual death is done. They are truly alive, right? And so the only death left is the death that's an inconvenience. The biggest thing has already happened. We have been buried with Christ in baptism, even by sprinkling on the forehead. We have been buried. And so the life I now live, right, I live through faith in Christ who was crucified for me. And so hopefully, and we'll see if Pastor Borland remembers how to close this out, we've had guests who do better than others with it. As we remember that, as we daily remember our baptism, and I pray you do, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but do that. As we remember our baptism and that we have already died the big death, that is out of the way. What really do we have left to do, John?
Let the bird fly.
Very good.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to clown. I don't care what the people are thinking, I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set him up, another round. I set him up, another round. I set him up, another round. One more round won't get me down. I don't care.